Accession number 31407.
Ron Creighton, Reel 8.
We had to do ship's duties, and we usually had to do some ship duties, and I said, all right, we'll do officer of the patrol, which I thought was a good luck. And so I said, well, I'll do the first trip. And I went out with the provost marshal from Hamburg in his jeep. And he took me all around Hamburg and showed me all the damn the red light district and here, there and everywhere, which was great fun. And I also flew the Burgermeister, or whatever the German equivalent, I think it's Burgermeister, so the mayor of Hamburg, all around Hamburg, so he could see it from the air after the bombing.
This is 56,
10 years after the war.
So it's still pretty flat.
It's still in a lot of ruin, yeah. Let's have a think.
Helicopters improving in design, sonar, I don't know any.
Well, certainly the helicopters were improving amazingly.
And the Admiralty was getting more, being persuaded to the case that
By then,
the argument was...
When I look back, I mean, flying the early 51s, Dragonflies, when I started on, or going back even further than that, because the first helicopter I remember, I flew as a test pilot at Worthy Down in 45. That was actually flown by an RAF chap who brought it into what's name, and we all flew in that one. And that would barely get off the ground at all if there wasn't wind.
You weren't trained how to fly helicopters then, were you?
No, I did take the controls and fly a bit, but I hadn't done a course. But it was like comparing the Blériot machine, or even the Wilbur Wright's machine, to, say, the Spitfire or the Hurricane. I mean, this was the advance was between 45 and 55 is unbelievable.
And a lot of money was being thrown at the design, I imagine. And did you?
Well, Sikorsky was the big man and the big firm that were doing it. Well, what we were doing.
Wasn't it Westlands then?
Westlands were, but they were building. They were building the American aircraft under license. There were other firms in England. Ferries were building. They built, and Bristol's built the Sycamore, which was a failure. Ferries' big one was the Rotodyne, which again was a tremendous great thing. And I mean, it was scrapped. I think purely and simply financially, it was out of control. And then there was Saunders Row. Well, they did eventually produce. They had a little, what was it called, the first one? Oh, dear. Skeeter was their first one, which was all right. But then they came on and eventually developed the Wasp and the Scout. Scout being used by the Army and the Wasp being used by the Navy. And they were quite good little helicopters. And then Westlands took all that lot over. Bristol's, Ferries, Saunders Row all became part of the Western Group. But Western's mainly made its money by building American Sikorsky aircraft under license. Now, Western's, in the old days, built fixed-wing aircraft. We don't want to go into that. But the big helicopter they built was the Westminster, which, again... They never really built a fuselage. The fuselage they had was almost like an electricity pylon with a propeller on the back end and one on up above. Building great thing. And a little small cockpit in the front. I mean, they had lovely drawings and mock-ups of what the thing could be, but again, it never came to anything.
Were you ever
but that was after... Long time after. That was when I was working as test pilot in Western.
But when you were in the Navy as flying as a pilot, were you ever consulted by helicopter designers? Did they ever come and talk to people like you, or was that going on elsewhere?
Well, when I was at Gosport, we were in very close contact with Westerns, yes. We always had a Westerns rep with us to help look after the maintenance side. And we'd very often go up to Westerns and we'd, over a gin and tonic or something, we'd discuss with the directors and the design staff up there about the helicopter, yes. Which goes back, and it's just something of memory comes back. Going back to the Dutch floods, when we got back, Westerns did give us a very good party. They had us all up into Yeovil. And we had the most marvellous helicopter made of chocolate. It was about 6 feet long. It was an absolute replica of the old dragonfly. You see, these things keep coming in.
Great, good moment to stop there.
In the middle of it, because the Suez crisis starts flaring up. You're online, are you?
Yep.
The Suez crisis starts flaring up, and immediately, for some reason unbeknown to me, but only probably the CO, it was decided that we should partake in Suez and take troops ashore. So we immediately stripped the aircraft of all the sonar equipment and put back in the troop lifting seats. And we then went aboard the Ocean and the Theseus and were working out techniques and practices for getting the troops and the best way to get them on board and get them off safely. And
do you have any idea when this is exactly? This would be Suez.
Would it be in 56?
But when about in 66? Suez, the landings were towards the end, October, I think.
That's right, so yeah. So it'll be probably in about early May.
Plenty of time in advance.
I mean, a long time in advance, yeah.
Bubbling away. Yeah. But was it secret at all? I mean, was there any secrecy attached to it? Or was?
Not really, no. I mean, the CO, he was a funny CO, actually. He was very seldom with us. He was... shouldn't really say this online, but he was usually skiving off in London seeing one of his girlfriends, and I was left in charge. I mean, I know a lot of it, he was probably up in the Admiralty, but I know I did have various occasions when his wife would ring up and I'd have to make excuses for where he was, actually. But he probably knew more about it, but I would have to address my squadron troops, and they'd say, you know, what is happening? And I'd say, well, I don't know, but they wouldn't believe me. And I said, well, I just don't know, and I can't tell you. I said, we know the Suez campaign is going, and I said, but other than that, and we've taken the equipment out, what we can only surmise what's in store for us. Anyway, we did this. We were on and off board the Ocean and the Theseus. We were up in Ireland in Eglinton when it started blowing up. And then we did a quick dispatch south. And it's quite a job, actually, because we had about 50 on the squadron maintenance staff. And God knows how many tons of stores, because we had to carry our own stores around with us for the aircraft. And this lot had to be shipped from Eglinton down wherever we went pretty smartly. Anyway, we got it all down back down to Lee. And then we were on and off these two ships for quite some considerable time. And I know it was in the summer, and I know we went into Hamburg and then into Bremen during this period, and it just went on and on without really knowing what was happening.
And you were practicing with troops?
We were practicing with the troops, yes.
With the Marines?
We had the Marines there.
So they were quick getting out,
yeah, and working out where we put the aircraft on deck and how we would take off and That's right.
And this is the first time that helicopters would have been used for
First time they'd ever been used for this sort of thing, yeah.
And Suez is bubbling away in the background.
We were bubbling around until...
Nasser is making his speech.
Until eventually we're leaving Portsmouth Harbour, and it was rather like the troops leaving for the Falklands. Everyone was on the shore. Everyone seemed to know what was going and waving, and we were standing on the deck in unusual naval fashion, manning the side. And off we sailed to Malta. We had been to Malta before. In fact, we were there the Christmas before, because they'd flown us back for Christmas leave, actually, from Malta. And we eventually stayed, and we knew it was coming up, and we were almost on the assault day. The RAF had bombed the various airfields, and we were on our way to Suez. And we got there, and I was senior pilot, was briefed to take off before the actual 0 hour for takeoff, to go and investigate and see if I could find another suitable place for landing other than the de Lesseps statues, as previously we had been going to land on the Sweetwater Canal, but they decided that there were far too many Bofors guns there and the risk was too great, so that was scrapped. And then we were told to land at the de Lesseps statue, but they thought that would be overcrowded. So I took off and flew in to shore to literally to the Lesseps statue, and flew westward along the coast, and was subjected to fire most of the way along. And we came to a stadium, and I thought this was a very good place. I had a marine officer up the front with me, who agreed that that was quite a good place. And we went in and landed. And having disembarked all the troops, include
how many troops would a helicopter then be able to carry?
I think there were about eight in the back, and I had one up the front. And they all disembarked, and I took off. And on my takeoff, just after takeoff, there was a rather loud bang. And then I later discovered, as I was flying away, that I'd got no radio control, and I tried to call up and tell them where I'd landed these troops so the rest could come in there. So I decided to go in to inform the people that I'd just dropped off that I'd got no radio. And I touched down, and almost before I touched down, they all rushed back and got in the aircraft. So I thought, well, that's it. So off we took again and flew back along the coast eastwards, and took them then into the Lesseps statue area, by which time the rest of the squadron were already there and disembarking the troops. I landed. I flew back to the ship. And as soon as I landed, instead of picking up another load of troops, I was told to close down. And on closing down, they said that there was fuel pouring out from the petrol tanks. And the aircraft was riddled with bullet holes. And there was a large hole in my seat pan about the size of a dinner plate. Whatever it was, it was absorbed by the rubberized hair cushion that I was sitting on. And I was very lucky. All the blades were holed, and the aircraft was put out of action completely. And that was really the end of my story of Suez. We stayed there only a couple of days, and we then had to withdraw quickly because the Americans had come in against us. And as we were flying American aircraft, which were on lease loan from the Americans, we had to withdraw. So So we were pulled out and went back to Malta.
And what, you took the troops, you went in and took the troops who were brought back on the ship?
Or no, the troops stayed there, no. We then acted, we did have some casualties on board, and mainly Egyptians that were ferried on board, and I don't know what happened, we probably took them back to Malta with us, actually.
What was the feeling on the ship when you were told to pull out?
Well, we were all terribly disappointed, actually. It's a strange thing, isn't it? No, I think we were looking forward to making more of an effort, and we weren't able to. It was like my good friend Dennis White, who I mentioned earlier as creator of the museum at Yeovilton. When the Falklands on was, he was most disappointed that they wouldn't let him rejoin and go out there.
So you come back to Malta, I suppose.
We came back to Malta. We then, of course, put all the sonar equipment back and took out the seats, and we resumed our task then as anti-submarine squadron.
Back in the UK?
Well, I think from that time we stayed in Malta and then eventually came back to the UK, probably about Christmas time.
So you're now a senior... You're a lieutenant commander of senior pilot.
Senior pilot of squadron.
845 yeah. Squadron. What happens next? The Suez debacle goes down.
After my term there, I suppose I'd been probably a year, 18 months. I was then relieved of my commission to that squadron, and I was sent to a trials unit at Leon Solent. And I can't think of anything which particularly happened there. I think, can I?
Sure.
Yes, other than being sent, well, I'd won that on the trials unit. The only other thing I did was go to Aberporth for some radar trials, where it was just a matter of the aircraft flying through radar beams to see where they were going. It was a pretty dull sort of thing, actually. But
helicopters?
In helicopters, yeah. Because we could go vertically. So. And whilst I was there, I fell sick of malaria, which I had. But I got over it. Then whilst on the trials unit, I was then sent to America, to Sikorsky's, to fly and give an assessment of the first night, what they call the first night system. It was, we had autopilot, and it was connected up to the sonar. It had a radio altimeter, and it also had a Doppler system, which registered your speed over the ground. And it was a fully automatic system, a purely push button. You push the button, you set a height, you push the button, negative speed, and the aircraft would automatically take off. You then put in a speed and a height, and it would then go up to that height. And you fly at that height, and then you want to go down, so you set the low position again, sort of 50 feet, zero speed, and it would come back down and hover. Then you lower the ball down into the water, and then there were two pickups on the cable, so that if the cable started drifting, this went into the autopilot and kept the aircraft in a hover position. And it was the beginning, really, of the automatic systems.
And what was your impression of it?
Well, I was most impressed. But the only thing was that we'd always been flying with just a single pilot. And we decided that the workload was so great for the pilot monitoring these systems that it would need two pilots. So it was myself he was responsible really for bringing in two pilots in the helicopter.
So it almost defeated the purpose of it, didn't it? If it was, I mean, if you had to have two pilots to make it effective, or...
Well, it did it better than the pilot could do it, particularly at night, when you couldn't see anything. You got no references to horizon, the workload to have done that. I mean, in the early days of... We tried night flying in Dragonflies way back in 705 Squadron, using an Aldis lamp, shining it out so we could see the ground. It was so primitive.
So this
but this system was fantastic.
Where did you test this? Where in the States were you?
At Bridport. In Sikorsky Works.
And you, that was, and you actually flew at night occasionally, I imagine,
yep,
to test
it? Flew at night and by day. And it was very interesting, actually. It was, when we got there, it was very, very slow. We were fitted with badges, and we could only go into certain areas of Sikorsky's. According to the number, you could go through certain number doors. And it was really so we could get to the pilot's office. We sat there for days and did nothing. And there was an American there, who'd just come out of the American Navy. And I can always remember him saying, "God damn it, man, if this firm don't hurry up, they're supposed to be employing me. If they don't give me something to do, I was just getting back out." And, oh, I don't think, you know, we went there and we kept saying, "When am I going to fly? When am I going to fly?" And no one could tell us anything. And then eventually we did fly it, but they gave us really very little time on it. It was enough to assess it.
And you had to make reports on what you thought was improved. And
well, when I came back, I immediately went to... I had to write reports, which I wrote, and then I went to several meetings, and the thing was discussed at meetings. And then the next thing I knew was I was appointed to the Ministry of Supplies, it was then. And there was a group, as a Captain Axford engineer, whom I knew because I'd met him earlier in my service career. And he said, "Ron, we're sending you to work at Westerns with the chief test pilot on the development of the one end system, which we're going to fit into the Wessex aircraft." So I went off and went to Westerns.
Still
in the Navy. And then they said, "Why don't you come and work for us?"
And this was at the period that John Shoebridge was telling me about, that Duncan Sands was laying off a lot of naval officers.
He was laying off at that time, yeah.
And you, what, weighed up, I imagine, weighed up the options that were open to you professionally.
Well,
you're obviously fond of the Navy. It must have been a wrench.
It was a wrench. At that time, I'd been away so much. My first wife, Pat, didn't like me being away so much. And it was a lot due to her that I decided, you know, that I'd go to Western, thinking that I'd have a nice, steady job, home at night. Much to my surprise, it didn't work out. After I joined Western, I was always away. I was up at Fairies, or I was at Bristol, or Saunders Row, or I was on a sales tour, or something, or I was away in Paris at an air show. So I was away equally as much. But I did have the advantage of not only doing most of the work on the one-end system on the Wessex, but I also flew the first Sea King helicopter.
And had a lot of input into the design? Or,
and well, quite a bit into everything there, yes. And it was the first aircraft, the first helicopter, which really and truly felt as if you were flying a fixed-wing aircraft. Gone with all the heavy controls and the instability. It was beautiful. It was an absolute fantastic aircraft.
And it's only just been decommissioned, hasn't it?
We're still using them now.
Are they?
Yeah. It's been taken over by the Merlin.
Hmm. Going back to you leave the Navy in 1958. Were the Navy, I should imagine, they were pretty reluctant to let you go because you were highly trained?
Well, I was surprised they let me out. But I think, I didn't realise it, but Westerns wanted a test pilot. And I think that possibly, due to my experience on the helicopters, I'd been everywhere. I've been in the Arctic. I've been in the tropics. I've been on ships. I've done rescue. You name it, with a helicopter, I've done it. So
you think Westland put a bit of pressure on the Navy to let you go?
And... Well, I think possibly, yeah. But I've always felt, I don't know, that I was tended to be fed into the job. There's a job going there. Because the strange thing was, there's a chap living in Tynmouth, Roy Hawkes, whom I know applied to because he came out of the Navy about that time with the axe they had, and he applied to Westerns for the job, for a bit of job as a test pilot, and he was turned down. It was about the same time that I went in, but I did have all this knowledge, which he hadn't. He was a helicopter pilot, but he hadn't got the same experience as I got.
Great. Well, I think we've more or less we've done it, haven't we? We've come to the end of your service career. Is there? I mean, I always ask this at the end. Is there anything? It's very difficult to say that you've missed, that you think we've missed, and we haven't talked. It's very, very difficult to compress. You know, this huge, long, interesting, and varied career of yours into what four hours or whatever we've done. But is there anything you think that we could have spent more time on, or that? Leaps to mind now, will probably leap to mind just after I leave, but
that's what will happen.
Yes,
as I said earlier, I think, you know, if I'd had my logbooks, it would have been much more of a help.
Well, never mind.
That's given you some idea.
Yes, no, it has. I think we'll stop there. Thank you very much. That's great.
Right.
Thanks. Yep, so we just